Hello and welcome to this week's Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast in the Inner Sanctum. Thanks as always for joining me and for joining the Inner Sanctum. Supporting me, my family and my work, always appreciated. Please know that. So we're continuing here, the second. I don't know whether it'll be the last or not. I'm going to wax the best I can to see where this takes us. But we're going to continue our discussion of chivalry and literature. So last week we sort of established, if you like, the ground rules, the foundation upon which all else will be built and discussed. But now we're going to get to chivalry itself. And one of the key things about chivalry, of course, etymologically, it just means that relates to horses. Chevaux being, or cheval, I think, being a French for horse. But of course, beyond that, it really means that it means putting responsibilities before one's rights. And this, of course, connects chivalry with acts of self-sacrifice. And ultimately, acts of self-sacrifice are acts of love. So from a Christian perspective, of course, as I never tire of saying, because our age seems unable to grapple this foundational reality, aspect of reality, that love is not a feeling or an emotion, it's a conscious decision, it's an act of the will, it's a rational choice. And it's the rational choice to lay down our lives for the other. So at the heart of chivalry is the embrace and the acceptance of laws of responsibility that transcend and override any so-called rights we may have. And another conversation we could have at some point, and perhaps will have, is how perhaps one of the root problems of our present society is that it's no longer a society that's rooted in our responsibility towards others, but in our rights. Because having a society based upon our rights invariably tends towards me being more concerned about my rights over the rights of others, which becomes a society which rips itself apart in a frenzy of selfishness. So this is the problem we find ourselves in now, and one of the reasons for it. But for chivalry, it's always putting responsibility before rights. The French phrase, which I'm sure we know, which is connected to chivalry, is noblesse oblige. In other words, that to have a noble disposition, whether it's the artificial nobility of social class, or the real nobility of sanctity, that to have that nobility obligates us. In other words, that a saint acts as the saint must. He is always going to put his obligations before his personal selfish desires. Of course, a saint ultimately is someone who has managed, by the grace of God, to make his desires and his obligations the same, a perfect synthesis of what one wants and what one must do. That is holiness. The rest of us are still striving to get there, and therefore there's the conflict within us. So chivalry puts responsibility before rights, the concept of noblesse oblige, that the nobility of soul obligates action. And I would say the other way of looking at that is the dignity demands. In other words, that from a Christian perspective, the dignity of the human person, every human person, demands our response, the word responsibility, okay, that demands our responsibility towards that soul because of the dignity that that soul demands of us. So responsibility before rights, noblesse oblige, and dignity demands. Now, in the history of chivalry, there's always the lady. And who is the lady? Well, C.S. Lewis makes a fatal error rooted in his own residual anti-Catholicism. And anybody that knows me knows I love C.S. Lewis, so please forgive me if you need to for arguing with the great man. But he did have his blind spots, and one of them was a sense of discomfort with the devotion that Catholics feel towards the Mother of God. And he stated that the medieval cult of the Lady, Amour Courtois, courtly love, decayed into love for Our Lady, the devotion to the Virgin. An actual fact, and of course, anybody who knows anything about history knows that it's the other way round, that the devotion to the Blessed Virgin goes back to the earliest times in the church, back to the church, to the time of the disciples himself, to the words of Christ from the cross, etc., etc. And as the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance, that these an element of, should we say, worldliness, of secularism, of corruption, that the cult of the Virgin, of the Blessed Virgin, of Our Lady, becomes the cult of the Lady. And this decay continues because Amour Courtois, courtly love, in many respects, just becomes a refined artifice for seducing the lady, often, in fact, a married lady. So it actually becomes the etiquette of adultery. So how far does that get us actually from true chivalry? You know, if the rules of chivalry are used to seduce a married woman, then the rules are being used to actually violate the thing for which they were framed in the first place. Look at this. How does courtly love, this love for the lady and Our Lady, play itself out? Well, obviously we have, you know, phrases such as les jongleurs de Dieu, God's jugglers, the troubadours, these wandering minstrels and poets who wandered around singing of courtly love, and indeed of love for the Virgin. This plays itself out in early music. In fact, in some of my favorite music is, I can't pronounce it in medieval Spanish, so I'm not going to try, but it translates into English as the Red Book of Montserrat. And this contains music dedicated to the Virgin, to the Blessed Virgin. So it's religious music, but it's joyful, it's merry. It's sort of like the troubadour singing. It's like medieval, late medieval, early Renaissance folk music. So it's jolly. You can dance to it. So it's unsuitable for the liturgy. Obviously, it lacks the decorum and the dignitas, if you like, of what's necessary for the liturgy. But it's joyous and joyful music. Dedicated to the Virgin. I mean, why would we not love that? Why would not our love for the Blessed Virgin make us want to sing and dance? So again, there's something that, if you like, a Franciscan spirit, spirit of the troubadours. So this, if you like, is how chivalry, courtly love, and Amour Courtois plays itself out actually in religious music in the late Middle Ages. We see, of course, in Dante's love for Beatrice, this understanding of the man being unworthy of the lady. Again, reminded perhaps of words from the Mass, Domine non sum dignus, Lord, I am not worthy, that perhaps we are not worthy of the lady. Dante certainly never feels worthy of Beatrice. And the whole of the Divine Comedy can be seen, if you like, as the purification of Dante's love for Beatrice. He's chastened into chastity by Beatrice and by the workings of Divine Providence as it plays itself out in the Divine Comedy. So, if you like, Dante learns in that poem to overcome the tendency of a more courtoise towards lust, and to treat Beatrice with the dignity that her holiness and femininity demands, so that in actual fact, in the end, he treats Beatrice with the same decorous devotion that he treats the Blessed Virgin herself, perhaps not in the same echelons in terms of a hierarchy, but the same in type, a purity, a chastity, a devoutness in the love of Dante, both for the Blessed Virgin and for Beatrice. We see, by the way, lest we want to try to make this relationship, this honourable relationship between man and woman, something which is purely something which emerges in the Middle Ages, let's remind ourselves of Odysseus and Penelope. Penelope in the Odyssey is a woman who is far superior in terms of integrity, piety, loyalty, strength, and especially in face of tribulation and temptation, far exceeds in those things Odysseus, who's reckless and spends the whole epic learning to be worthy of Penelope. So this is something, if you like, it's part of the perennial, permanent reality of the relationship between men and women, that men need to treat their women with the dignity that the woman, as a human person and as a feminine human person, demands. In Shakespeare, we see his treatment of the relationship between men and women in terms of chivalry various ways. He's a realist in the best sense of the word. So in Romeo and Juliet, we see how Romeo, the older man, is a cad who employs his charm to seduce the innocent 13-year-old Juliet in her naivete into the first kiss and the second kiss. And then, of course, because there's no decorum, because there's no chivalry, because there's no putting responsibility before rights, because there's no noblesse oblige, because there's no acceptance of dignity demands, the absence of chivalry leads, of course, to the headlong destruction of the lovers. The fact that there's an absence of chivalry on the part of both sets of parents and their extended families exacerbates the process. On the other hand, however, we have The Merchant of Venice. And in that, we see Portia as an icon of idealized femininity, but not in any passive way. Portia, again, is by far not merely the most virtuous character in the whole play, but the smartest, the cleverest. And of course, there's a big difference between being clever and being wise. Well, she has both, and she knows what order to put them in. She is obedient to the will of her father, knowing that her father was himself wise. She puts her responsibilities before her rights in her acceptance and embrace of the test of the caskets. She has a great sense of doing what is right and of sacrificing herself for it. Again, as with Dante, with Beatrice, the large part of The Merchant of Venice, is Bassanio learning by trial and error and ineptitude and through the patience of Portia to become the man he needs to be in order to actually woo the lady and to be, I don't know if he's worthy of the lady even then, but to be someone who's at least endeavouring to live up to the demands of chivalry with respect to his relationship. We'll finish with today. We will be carrying on now because there's other works of literature I want to discuss. There'll be at least one more. But while I'm on Shakespeare, we'll finish with Shakespeare. Shakespeare's final play, the final play he wrote in its entirety, is The Tempest. And again, Miranda in that play has never seen a man except for her father. She and her father, when she was an infant, when she was very young, they were marooned on a desert island, so she's known no man, and she the only man that she has any knowledge of is her father. So Ferdinand arrives on the scene. She falls headlong in love with him, but this again the difference between Ferdinand and Miranda and Romeo and Juliet. The great sense of humour in Shakespeare when first of all that Prospero demands basically gives Ferdinand onerous labor such as moving logs, lifting, carrying the weight of logs. It's a metaphor for carrying of the cross, picking up the wood, bearing the burden of the wood, moving the logs. And this, again, Prosper is saying, you know, are you worthy of my daughter's hand in marriage? Will you take up your cross? Will you sacrifice through labour for her? And he passes that test. He doesn't refuse to do the labour. He does it in obedience. And then the best thing about it, and he will finish, you know, the phrase in flagrante delecto, when people are caught in flagrant delight. It normally refers to a man and a woman being caught in the act of sexual union, often illicitly, in other words, often adulterously or in some other sense. What I love about Shakespeare's sense of humour and his showing the chivalrous nature of the relationship between Miranda and Ferdinand in The Tempest is that Prospero, if you like, checks on Ferdinand and Miranda to make sure that they're not getting up to anything they shouldn't. And he discovers them in flagrante delicto, but what they're the flagrant delight is not with each other's physical bodies. They are having a delightful game of chess. And you can't find anything further from the act of copulation or the sin of lust than a game of chess. This is Shakespeare's sense of humour. T.S. Eliot runs with that that allusion in The Wasteland when he actually names one of the parts of The Wasteland a game of chess. The whole part is about the act of lust, but the irony with the connection to The Tempest is obvious. Okay, so we've gone from defining chivalry, what it is, its connection to love and responsibility. And we've talked about the music of chivalry being the troubadours, but also the Red Book of Montserrat, this wonderful book of wonderful, joyful music to the Virgin that you can sing a dance to. We looked at Dante and Beatrice and Odysseus and Penelope, and we ended up with examples of chivalry and its absence in the relationship between men and women in the plays of Shakespeare. We'll continue our discussion of chivalry and literature next week. Until then, thanks so much as always for joining me. And until next week, continue to have a joyous, glorious, and blessed Easter season.